Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Jeremy Whitcup, the Chief Technology Officer at IntelliSecure. IntelliSecure is a leading managed security services provider focused on data protection, and they're based out of Denver, Colorado, with a second security operations center in the United Kingdom. Jeremy, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you for joining us on a Saturday afternoon here. Your background seems quite varied. Can you explain to us how you got interested in cybersecurity and what brought you into IntelliSecure?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I started my adult life in the military, and I was in the Army, and there were a variety of different things going on in the post-9/11 world when I was in the Army and in theater. And a lot of those things had to do with pieces of information that were highly sensitive and not always necessarily well protected, and things like behavior patterns and understanding, you know, threats and risks, and those kinds of things were fascinating to me. And then on the other side of the equation, we had, you know, the availability of things like live video of battlefields that were streaming from helicopters or drones down to the battlefield, and then how do we secure that information was always interesting to me. So after I got out of the military and I went to college, I was working with General Dynamics, which is a government contractor, and kind of dealing with the same thing, vehicle platforms and mission systems. And as I decided that I wanted to kind of make a transition from government contract work into something else, that something really, cybersecurity really spoke to me. And so I started doing some research on my own, some self-education, and the more I learned about it, the more I was fascinated by cybersecurity as a way to you know, embrace all the things I loved about the military without having to put my life on the line and travel to the Middle East. So it seemed like a good blend.
Yeah, gotcha. Sounds excellent. Congratulations. Oh, I just want to tell you, thank you for your service in the military. I always try to tell people that. So thank you once again for your
my
service.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, how long has IntelliSecure been in business? Is this a company that you kind of helped create or
No, so it's interesting. So IntelliSecure was founded in 2002. It was under a different name. It was called BW Global, which were the initials of the founders, and still was when I joined in late 2010, early 2011 timeframe. At that time, there were very few people, less than 20 people in the company, and it had really been a value-added reseller for this kind of quaint and obscure technology, data loss prevention in the early days. And then over the years, as the technology started to grow, the business started to grow, and they started to offer some services. And right around the time I joined, they had started to offer a managed services offering that was a little bit different than most managed security services providers, in that it really focused on technologies that were more business-centric and less technology set it and forget it. And that came with an interesting set of challenges and an interesting set of opportunities. So I joined the managed services department in 2010. Like I said, we're less than 20 people, probably more like 12 or 14 people at that time. And at this point, we're over 200 on two continents with security operations centers in both the United States and in Europe, which is pretty exciting.
Okay, all right. That's a phenomenal growth rate. Now, what types of customers do you provide services for? I mean, what's their size, what they do, and where they're located?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we historically were a large enterprise services organization. Most of our clients, while you've probably never heard of us, you've definitely heard of our clients, and I can't mention them by name, but they're large companies, household names, mostly multinational organizations. Within the last couple of years, we've taken what we've learned from working in those large and complex environments and really built some services that are more cost-effective and allow organizations that are maybe a little bit smaller with less resources, both in terms of personnel and capital, to be able to embrace some of the solutions that the larger enterprises have. And I think the timing of it is really interesting, because as we see more and more data protection regulations around the world, small companies need to comply with those regulations just like large companies do. So we've built some offerings recently in the last 18 months to allow us to service a wider variety of organizations. As far as verticals, top verticals are financial services, healthcare, and manufacturing, but we have organizations of every size and flavor at this point. Our smallest client is about 300 employees, and our largest client is about 450,000 employees.
Well, okay. Now, what types of services does IntelliSecure provide? I mean, how are the services made available? Are they on-prem or in the cloud or maybe a combination of both, perhaps?
Yeah, traditionally we had three service lines that would kind of work together. We had a consulting services group that would go through and work with the business and define business rules and define things like RACI matrices and things like escalation procedures and work instructions and that kind of thing. We had a technical group that would deploy technology mostly on premises in a client organization for licenses that they own. And then we had a managed services department that would then take over both the programmatic element as well as the technical element over time and work with our clients. More recently, as we're going through this kind of thought exercise for how do we take these high-end, very costly services and make them less expensive but still valuable to smaller organizations, we've kind of blurred the lines between those groups and they operate a little differently. And we also have created a cloud-hosted, fully managed offering for clients that just want to be able to deploy capabilities and don't necessarily want to take an active role in the building of the policies or the construction of the program.
Okay. Now, can you get into some more detail about the technological architecture that you use for your services?
Yeah, so all of the technologies that we support are commercial off-the-shelf technologies, and I'll talk a little bit about what those technologies are in a moment, but the architecture is really based on what those technologies offer, with the exception of our cloud architecture, where we've taken certain technologies that are pretty universally adopted by most of our clients and then put them into a cloud environment and delivered them as a service. For the most part, the technologies are architected in a way where there's a centralized management server and a database, and then there's several collection type of servers, whether that be servers that can scan file shares or databases or servers that can manage a group of end-user computing devices to monitor types of information and the way that it flows throughout those devices, or different servers that can integrate with mail servers or web servers to look at traffic as it traverses a network. So those types of traditional architectures are supported. Types of products we supported is also interesting because we started with data loss prevention, which was, you know, a technology, like I said, in 2002, which was kind of released around the formation of our company. Our founders were very intrigued by it. But then we've had to branch out in order to comprehensively protect information. There's a lot more than one technology that goes into that overall stack. So we've started supporting things like data classification and cloud access security brokers and user and entity behavioral analytics and system incident and event management software and different ways of using encryption on a file basis and decryption to enforce rights management on and off a network or inside or outside an organization's zone of control. So architecture does vary based on capabilities, but we do offer on-premises and in the cloud solutions for our clients.
Awesome. Now, here as we get deeper into Q2 here, 2019, you know, data protection is like a huge thing in cybersecurity. And data protection, I mean, there's all kinds of data out there, big data, PII stuff. It can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but what does it mean specifically to you as a CTO of IntelliSecure and to the company in general?
Yeah, so data is absolutely ubiquitous at this point. So many people have it, and it's in so many different places, and protecting it is such a challenge. So for me, data protection isn't an individual technology. It's almost an art and a science to say, how do we identify the data that we care about? How do we watch it everywhere it goes? And how do we exert control over it, even when it's left our traditional direct zone of control? So ideas like I can take a piece of information, if it's very sensitive, I can encrypt it, and I can issue every authorized recipient a unique key. And then if that authorized recipient starts behaving in a way I don't like or forwards it to a bunch of people that don't have authorization to view that information, then I can destroy that key and revoke access to that document after it's left my direct control. These types of capabilities and these types of things are interesting, and they give us opportunities we've never had before to protect information, but it also comes with a significant amount of work that goes into making a program like that work seamlessly and flawlessly. And I think to sum it all up from my perspective, data protection is as much about freeing the good as it is stopping the bad with respect to how data is used. Because if you wanted to just say, I never want to let my data leak, then you would never put it in an electronic form in the first place, right? That's the easiest way to keep control over it. Keep it in printed form and lock it away in a safe. It's harder to copy. It's harder to gain access to. But as soon as you fix it in digital form, you're doing so in order to enable people to profit from it or maximize its value. So we can never forget in security that it's not just about stopping bad things from happening, it's also enabling good things to happen. And that's applicable to data, it's applicable to the cloud adoption trends that we're seeing in business, and it's applicable to, you know, things like user and entity behavioral analytics as well.
Sounds good. Now, traditional technologies like DLP are getting kind of outdated. They're kind of becoming like a dinosaur. What are the emerging trends that you see in data protection? I mean, what comes next? Are we going to see like more attacks, more hacks, more legislation? I know that the EU has been very proactive with their GDPR. They really, you know, they charge a very hefty fee if companies are not compliant with it. Now, there are other companies like Vietnam and Thailand and in the Pac Rim area where they're coming out with their own cybersecurity legislations. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think when GDPR first came out, especially for non-European citizens, it was a bit of a kind of eyebrow-raising experience. It was, and there was a lot of pushback on it. But if you really read what GDPR is trying to accomplish, I think most people would, especially people with children, would say this is probably a necessary safeguard for people that are growing up in this digital native world. The truth of the matter is GDPR, aside from all the hype around fines, is really set out to establish rights for data subjects, which is all of us, and responsibilities for people who process that data. It seeks to limit the amount of time an organization can keep data that they've lawfully collected, and it also seeks to limit or give data subjects control over what data is collected and how long it's retained. That's become very popular around the world, and frankly, I think it's a good idea, even though it makes my job harder. I think things like API in Japan are very similar. Brazil has civil rights framework for the internet. Canada's had PIPEDA since 2002, which has some similar tendencies. Australia has regulations. We're seeing regulations all over the United States, whether it be Colorado or California or New York or Massachusetts. There's all statewide regulations. I think the biggest problem with all the regulatory environment is that it needs to be standardized. It's too hard right now to comply. Even organizations who really want to comply, there's just too much to comply with. So things like national cybersecurity legislation in the United States make a lot of sense. Maybe having some cybersecurity treaties at the NATO level makes sense to say, all right, well, you know, GDPR and whatever we pass in the U.S. and all the other, you know, countries that are at NATO or even the U.N. maybe, we agree on some standards that are going to be universally applicable to international commerce, because the problem is the internet doesn't respect terrestrial borders very well. And it's really hard to say, I'm going to do business in one country and not another on the internet. That's very difficult to do. And that's one of the reasons why data sovereignty laws have become less popular over time. You didn't see that in GDPR. But I think, you know, as we continue to go, I think data loss prevention, it's had a 17-year run. That's a long time. It may eventually go away. I don't know when. I'm not going to prognosticate on that. But the idea that of content analytics, which is the central idea of data loss prevention, I don't think will ever leave us. I don't think we'll ever go back to a time or be able to go back to a time where we can say we don't care what the content of a packet is when it traverses a network. We don't care what type of data is in that packet. I think we'll always need that. And that's especially with things like GDPR, it'd be impossible to comply without some kind of content analytics capability. So we may call it something else, and some very clever marketing people may make a lot of money on rebranding it, kind of like next-gen firewall was the next UTM, right? Those types of things may happen, but content analytics, I think, is here to stay. And I think this type of regulation is going to increase, number one, in volume and velocity, and then number two is going to mandate that you have some kind of content analytics capability.
Gotcha. Well, kind of an offshoot of that question, you know, we're now hearing this thing called the Internet of Things. And to me, it's a very murky, and to me it's kind of scary. I mean, although, you know, we're cybersecurity professionals here, to me it's a very scary thing. Because, one, I don't like to see everything connected, and two, we're simply increasing the attack surface for the cyber attacker. But I know that California passed some legislation, I think they just enacted that this year. It's a very obscure and very vague law. What are your thoughts on just the IoT in general? I mean, from your background.
It's interesting because IoT has the potential to both be a fantastically good thing for humanity and also a really bad thing for humanity. And whether it's going to be which is probably going to be somewhere in the middle. I think we're very rapidly approaching kind of the Jeff Goldblum and Jurassic Park moment where we stop asking what we can do with respect to connecting devices and giving them the ability to make decisions and process information. And we really need to go towards whether we should be doing that. Does my refrigerator need to think? Does my washing machine need to think? And the benefits I get by having it think, are those outweighed by the risks posed by trying to secure it? And that's something that we're very rapidly approaching a time where we have to ask that question. Now, that being said, the Internet of Things, I don't think is good or bad. I think I would approach it like I approached the cloud 5 years ago when people first started asking me about that. I don't think it's good or bad. I think it is. I think it is what we make it, right? And we have to decide how we're going to use these devices and how we're not going to use these devices. The problem is if we continue to just let people run wild with their imagination and don't put any kind of rules or guidelines around what we should be doing with these devices, we're more likely to have an attack surface that we can't secure, to your point. But there are some very fantastic applications of connected devices that we absolutely should be looking into. I know, you know, there's some controversy around things like driverless cars because of their implications in the job market. But if you think about their potential implications on human safety, it's something we should be exploring. And we may never get there, right? But to where it's safe enough where we trust it, but we might. And that could revolutionize our society, and it could change things in a way we haven't seen since the Industrial Revolution in terms of how people spend their time in order to create, you know, economic prosperity for themselves and their society.
Well, yours is an interesting viewpoint because either I've heard people are for it or against it. I mean, your viewpoint is like the first, I think, neutral one that I've heard, to be honest. So, anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's good uses and there's bad uses, just like everything else. I mean, I don't know of many things in the technology world that are inherently good or bad. There's just good ways to use it and bad ways to use it, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Now, another hot-button topic that probably started late last year is now mobile data security. I mean, talking about the Internet of Things, I mean, here we have Siri and Cortana, you know, on Android and the iOS platforms. Our smartphones become like an extension of our personal and professional lives. It's like if we lose it or if it doesn't work, we're paralyzed. You know, we're at a loss. What do we do? I mean, like, what are your thoughts about it? I mean, on mobile data security?
It's interesting because I've heard people describe smartphones in two ways, and I think both of them are appropriate. I've heard people say smartphones are an extension of your brain, an extension of your body, and become such a ubiquitous tool that, and it's always in someone's hand, and they're always using it to the point where they're more functional with it than without it, which is kind of interesting and scary all at the same time. We're almost like cyborgs without the sci-fi definition, if you really think about it. But then the other side of the equation is people say a mobile device is just an extension of compute, but it's a compute device that the individual owns. And I think has been universally accepted that the individual retain ownership and control over that device, regardless of how they're using it in the workplace, which is a fundamental change in the way that we secure things in our environment. And I think it means that we have to take a harder look at securing information where information resides, because the idea that we're going to be able to control every endpoint that connects to our network is no longer a valid idea. And by the way, most organizations have all kinds of data that's outside their network and their direct control. So trying to put controls where the data exists, and that's where kind of cloud security comes into play and things like encryption come into play, because we have to put the controls where the data exists and the controls need to go with the data. We're not going to be able to control people's endpoints anymore. I think that ship has sailed, and anybody who's trying to look at an endpoint-centric way of securing holistically is missing the entire mobile problem, which is growing, I think.
Okay. Now, just another offshoot question here. I know that I've had some friends that attend the RSA conference, I think, back in March. I don't know if you did or not, but the big buzzwords right now are artificial intelligence and machine learning to automate, like, the most mundane tasks, like in pen testing and threat hunting. I've heard both good and bad. What are your thoughts on that, too? I mean, there's a flip side to that also. I mean, have you done much work on either side on AI or ML?
I have, and I do come from a government contracting background, and I've seen the beginnings of real AI at work, and I can tell you it doesn't exist in cybersecurity. One of the things that I said, you know, many times in public, and it's not my quote, I don't claim credit for it, but I say, you know, when you're talking AI and machine learning, if it's written in Python, it's probably machine learning. If it's written in PowerPoint, it's probably AI. And truth of the matter is, there are very few applications in cybersecurity of what I would consider true artificial intelligence. I think artificial intelligence in general is a very difficult thing. You know, I had some, you know, without getting too personal, I had some neurological issues in my neurologist. I was shocked by how much he admitted that they didn't understand about the human brain. So how are we ever going to artificially replicate something that we have such little understanding of? It's been called the most complex piece of matter in the universe. The idea that we're going to be able to replicate it in a meaningful way and then do it at scale and put it inside of the cybersecurity product to me is relatively laughable in terms of where we are right now as a society, and seems kind of arrogant. Now, machine learning is a completely different thing. Machine learning can work. There are applications of machine learning that are in use everywhere. And supervised models specifically have applications in cybersecurity that I know work and that we've leveraged and utilized. But I think we're not helped by the fact that people are overselling their capabilities by calling it artificial intelligence. Like, if you've ever seen videos on YouTube, like the Russians military has developed a robot that can shoot a gun and drive a car. That's AI, right? We're nowhere near that in the cybersecurity product. And the people at RSA, I said at RSA on a panel, and I probably wasn't the most popular person in the room when I said it, but what I said was if people spent half the money that they were spending just this week trying to convince you things that aren't AI are AI, they took that money and they recruited a more diverse skill set of people and actually train those people in cybersecurity, we'd be a whole lot better off. But we're spending far too much money on marketing and not enough time on recruiting the people that we actually need to run these solutions in a way that's meaningful. And by saying we have artificial intelligence, what we're saying is we're waving the flag saying we've solved the cybersecurity skills problem by saying that we don't need cybersecurity people, and that's just not true.
Okay. Well, let me ask you another thing. I have been using the two terms AI and ML, you know, synonymously in my blog post things when I talk to you. What is the difference between the two? I've kind of used the two interchangeably, you know, as together, but is there any difference between the two, technically speaking?
Yeah, there's a significant difference, yeah. There's a significant difference. I'm glad you asked that because I think there's a lot of misconceptions around this. Artificial intelligence is replicating the way that the human brain works so that inputs can equal outputs without necessarily being rule-based. So if you give me inputs, things that come in through my eyes, ears, and nose, my brain processes those things and makes decisions. Artificial intelligence is all about neural networks and replicating the way the human mind works so that machines can think. Machine learning is completely different. Machine learning is all about identifying patterns and replicating those patterns so that human beings don't have to intercede every time. That's the totally different things, right? But marketing would have you believe that anything that is machine learning is artificial intelligence, right? Because the word learning gets conflated with intelligence, but it's not the same thing. Actually, thinking is very different from teaching something to someone. You can teach a monkey how to do certain tasks, but it doesn't mean that they're cognitively processing things on the same level as a human being.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting you brought up about the human brain because my dad used to be a professor at Purdue. And he was actually involved in spinal cord regeneration research and trying to help make the spinal cord regenerate after it's been injured. So that brought up some.
That's fascinating. And the nervous system is complex enough. And we're starting to talk about advanced neural networks and things like that. And they do exist, right? I mean, they do exist, and people are doing research on them, and they're trying to do things, but what people are claiming to be AI versus what actually is, there's such a huge chasm that it's really stopping people from being able to have intelligent debate or evaluation because they're just discounting everything that they're hearing because they're hearing so much noise that is so clearly BS.
Right. Yeah, he died of a massive heart attack when he was only 58. But they say right before his passing, he was on sort of breakthrough. Where he discovered some kind of amniotic fluid or some kind of embryonic fluid to help kind of patch up the spinal cord. I don't remember what exactly transpired or what took off from there. But anyway, so let's segue back to your company. Now, as we said before the show started, there are plethora of cybersecurity vendors out there. You know, it seems like there's a brand new one coming out every day. Somebody's getting funded, you know, $3 million of VC money. How would you differ from the competition? In other words, why should customers say, hey, I'm going to come in to Intel Secure versus, let's say, company XYZ down the road?
Yeah, it's interesting. We are quite different because we're really trying to solve the people side of the equation. We're trying to solve for organizations that don't have the people to actually run all this fantastic technology that they've bought. And I think that's the difference. The vast majority of the money in cybersecurity is going to develop products, and a disproportionate amount of the spending is going to buy technologies that organizations never take off the shelf. And that's a problem everywhere, but it's confounded in American culture, and I've written about why I think that is, but they're just theories. Ultimately, the amount of spending on technology that U.S.-based organizations do versus people and process compared to the rest of the world is way out of whack. And so for you follow the money of spending, you'll see where people are investing in starting up. But what we really try to help organizations do is operationalize that technology, whether that means teaching them how to do it themselves or providing them with the experts that they need to accomplish their mission. And that is a little bit different. But in terms of cybersecurity, I hear, you know, an investment in how many companies there are. I hear the argument about noise, and I think it's a real thing. I think it is harder for organizations with really, truly good ideas to cut through all the noise today. But I also think it's good for the industry, because the truth of the matter is we're trying to solve a problem against a highly motivated, highly successful threat actor who values our information more than we do. You look at the global cost of cybercrime, it's about one-third of the global proceeds of cybercrime, which means they're three times as more motivated to steal from us as we are to protect it in financial terms. So we start to look at that, and we just need better ideas, more interesting ideas, and the best way to do that is to have as many people thinking critically about the problems as possible. So while, you know, 1 in 10 of these companies will probably survive, the next great idea may come from one of these companies that got VC funding, that if there wasn't so much interest in spending in this area, we would have never had that idea. So I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to have all these entrants in the marketplace, but I do think we are in the vast minority, and that we don't develop a technology solution. We try and provide experts to solve problems for organizations that have embraced a variety of technology solutions.
Okay. Now, I know that you come up with a new offering, Intel Secure FX. Are you using that to kind of break away from your traditional large enterprise market model?
I get that question a lot. I'm glad you asked it. No, it's not necessarily a pivot. It's more of trying to take everything that we've learned from our enterprise class customers and then provide these types of capabilities to organizations that couldn't have embraced them before. We talked a little bit about it being cloud hosted and prescriptive. If you have an organization and they're just trying to make it in, you know, financial services, banking, insurance, or healthcare, or something like that, and they just want to be able to be compliant, but they want to focus their energy on something else, we're giving them a turnkey solution that can help them grow and take that worry off their mind completely, where they don't have to participate. Our large enterprise clients are still a portion of our revenue, likely will be for the foreseeable future, and we love them. We're just trying to help more people.
Okay. Sounds good. Now, obviously, customers are important to any business. I mean, we all want new customers, you know, and repeat customers as well. Do you have any success stories that you'd like to share with us, any testimonials, case studies that you'd like our audience to know more about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, because of confidentiality agreements in this space and the things that we deal with being extremely sensitive, really can't name names. But I can tell you that we've had several cases that have been prosecuted at a federal level, both in the United States and outside of organizations who have had trusted employees stealing information from them in the attempt to try and profit from that, either by becoming a direct competitor or selling that information to someone else. We've stopped things from happening to organizations that are very similar to things you've seen in the news, like what happened to American Semiconductor that almost put them out of business when, you know, someone from a Chinese company offered one of their employees $2 million to steal information and give it to them. So we've been able to stop some of those high-profile intellectual property breaches that really don't make the news very often because they're very covert and clandestine, as well as we've really been able to help a lot of organizations avoid massive fines by just helping them shore up some of their broken business processes with respect to regulated data. And I think both of those things are equally as important to an organization. Ultimately, our clients are more successful and more able to meet their needs and evolve as a business because we're helping them take care of their data. And I think that's something that you would hear from any of our clients if you had the opportunity to speak to them.
Okay. Do you have any studies that you cite specifically without giving any customer names or anything? Like you implemented something just recently and, hey, it was a great thing for the customer. Is there anything you elaborate just a little bit more on?
Yeah, sure. About 18 months ago, we were working with an organization that's an international chemical manufacturer. They have operations in about 30 different countries. And one of the reasons why they came to us and wanted to implement a solution was their executive leadership team had an inkling that some of the intellectual property that they held both for themselves and their customers was making its way into competitive environments. So they deployed a solution ultimately, and the solution was combined between data loss prevention, cloud access security broker, and data classification all mixed together into the solution that would help them identify and protect their sensitive trade secrets, if you will. What we ended up finding was there was a salesperson actually in Germany that was downloading volumes of information to a USB device. And so he was someone who was actually very close to the CEO of the organization. So they didn't want to deal with him too heavy-handedly. So they reached out to him and they said, hey, we're going to disable everybody's USB ports. And just so you know, this type of information shouldn't be going outside of the company. The next day, actually middle of the night, we saw this individual downloading lots of information to a CD rewritable device because he realized that he had an old laptop, and while their USB had been disabled through corporate policy, through GPO, they had left the optical drive capable of having information. So anyway, they caught this guy, and when this guy was confronted by the authorities, it was found that this individual also had a job representing their top competitor from a sales perspective, and he was downloading information from both of those organizations and giving it to each other or using it against each other to help influence sales and maximize commission structures. So those types of things do happen. They can be very bad. Our most publicized case was probably 4 or 5 years ago where we actually caught a contractor for a company downloading intellectual property to according to the FBI, illegally mass produce competitive versions of his employer's product, and he was eventually sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. He's still sitting there right now. Mm-hmm. But we were able to catch that, and during the trial it came up that he had actually worked for two of that organization's competitors, and he had stolen similar information from them, but they never caught it. So had he not worked for a company that was under our protection, he would have got away with it. And when he was arrested at the Newark airport, he had a ticket to Bangalore, India, and his intention was to go back to India and start a company to compete with these three companies. And he had the plans from all of them. So he knew their strengths and their weaknesses, and he could reproduce what they did, and he could compete with them in a much lower cost of living country without having to spend the research and development dollars they had to spend. So unfair competition, corporate espionage, all of that. And he got away with it twice. He was relatively confident that he would be able to do it the same way again.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. Now, when you onboard customers and you reach out to potential customers in your sales cycles, do you offer any free trials or free risk assessments?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, an organization can reach out to us, and somebody like myself or somebody from my team will sit down with them and talk about what their issues are and what technologies they have and what they might need to solve their problems, and we'll put it all on a whiteboard for them, and generally that's free of charge. If they want to look at what the technologies can do, then we have different varieties of ways we can show them technologies. We can either do it for free, or some organizations want to take a little bit deeper dive, and based on how deep they want to dive, then our consultants can come out and lead that engagement for them as well. So we certainly do offer free trials and call it free consulting up front, just to help organizations see if this is really what they need to do, and if so, how important is it to them, and what they should do. A lot of organizations are just really confused. And I think you mentioned it earlier. There's just so much going on in the space, and there's so much noise that a lot of organizations are just legitimately confused about what's out there and what they should do.
Now, Let's now transition to the so one more point. Do you depend on a VAR, value-added reseller, strategic partner model for sales?
Yeah, it's interesting. We are strategic partners with a variety of technology vendors that we represent. I don't want to name them because if I forget one, they'll get really mad at me and I'll get a phone call on Monday. But we have a variety of technology vendors. We are vendor neutral in every space that we support. We used to be seen as a value-added reseller, and that's kind of the history of the company. We're really not anymore. We're a services company. We do resell some product, but the way that we report it makes it a very small portion of our revenue because we don't want to dilute our true business, which is providing services. So we have a lot of arrangements where we'll provide just the services and some other organization will resell the licenses. But we do have the ability to resell licenses, and we offer that primarily as a convenience to our customers. So if they want to buy services and licenses from the same people, then we can offer that to them.
Cool. Now, now as we kind of get into the final part of our show here, let's get back into the general cyber threat landscape. Every day, like last year, and then we keep hearing about the C-suite. And obviously you're part of C-suite too. You're a chief technology officer, and I've written a few blogs about making the C-suite more accountable and what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. In fact, I just wrote a blog on how we need more women CISOs out there more too. What are your thoughts on the C-suite being more held more accountable? Do you think a guy or gal should be fired just because of a security breach, their organization lose their job like that? Or, it's a
that's really
topic.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
a very interesting.
It's a very murky area. I'd hate to see someone lose their job because of something that really wasn't their fault. But there's so many ways to approach this. So what are your thoughts on that? Being a C-level exec too.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, I think it comes down to basic leadership. The buck has to stop with me. I've in my career taken responsibility and accountability for things that really I had nothing to do with because it was better for me to do that than to try and single out the individual. So I think, things like in the Equifax case where the CEO of the company points to an entry-level security administrator failing to do their job and says that person is the cause of this breach. If the process is broken to such a point where an entry-level employee can cause a large-scale breach, the process's fault, i.e. the responsibility lands with you, sir. So I do think that some of the scapegoating that's gone on is deplorable from a leadership perspective. I would say whether someone should lose their job or not is interesting. I've also had conversations with people, and I'll mention him because I'm sure he would enjoy the credit. His name's Barnaby Davis, and he works for a company called Doc Authority, and he's out in the UK. But one of his big things that he would say is, this is the only place in the world where victim blaming is okay, right? If I leave my door unlocked and somebody steals everything out of my house, they may say I'm an idiot, but I don't go to jail, right? At the end of the day,
right.
The people we can't forget that these organizations are victims of a crime in a well-funded multinational criminal enterprise. They said in 2017 the global proceeds from cybercrime were $1.5 trillion. If cybercrime was a country in 2017, it would have had the 13th largest GDP in the world. So for an organization to fall victim of something that's that well-funded isn't in and of itself a reason that organization should be sanctioned or that individual should be fired. What I would say is we need to hold people accountable to do the right things. So there should be some kind of basic level of these are the things that you must do. That's just basic due diligence, accepted as common sense, written down somewhere. If you're not doing those things, you're willfully negligent. Think of it as this kind of the same thing for malpractice in healthcare. If a patient dies, the doctor doesn't automatically get fired. But if the doctor didn't do some basic things to keep that patient alive, then they are liable for that. I think we need to adopt something like that in cybersecurity because there is some willful negligence that happens that causes people things, that costs people things. And the other thing is the response. I think the response is something you really can hold people accountable for because there's some really horrible things that have happened in some of the large-scale breaches that we've seen that have caused increased damage because speed is the key. If somebody steals my identity or my credit card and I know about it within days, I can pretty easily minimize that damage. But if I don't know about it for weeks or months, the potential damage to me as an individual goes way higher. So as is often the case, I think in cybersecurity incidents, the cover-up is far worse than the crime. And so executives who are making decisions as to whether we report these things or not, that are making the wrong decisions, need to be held accountable for those decisions. So I think you can see that it's a very nuanced issue, in my opinion, and there's lots of different aspects of it where, you know, I think people should or shouldn't be held accountable for certain things. Certainly don't think we should blame the victim, but I also don't think we should allow people to be willfully negligent and hurt other people in our society either. So hopefully that's a good answer to your question.
Yeah, it's a complex issue. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I ask every podcast guest I have about this. They all have their own different views. But I know that the C-level executives, I think the CISOs, I just read a report, I think, a couple weeks ago. As I said, I just wrote a blog on that. The CISO is doing a much better job of actually, you know, reporting back to the board of directors. There's more accountability like that too, you know.
I think CISOs historically have been precluded from doing that by organizational structure. I mean, in a lot of organizations, and I don't want to make a blanket statement, but a lot of organizations, having a CISO report to a CIO is like the fox guarding the hen house. The CISO needs to be able to blow the whistle to somebody who's not generally the person that is responsible for the exact opposite of what the CISO is responsible for. The CIO is all about availability and how fast can I make my network and how fast can I make things available and how freely can we share data. The CISO shouldn't be accountable to any of those things. The CISO should be all about how do I secure this information and how do I secure my infrastructure. So I think the changing in reporting relationships has helped that. I think that the average CISO is less of a, you know, technical person that got promoted all the way up to that role and more of a seasoned business executive nowadays, and I think that helps. And you mentioned, you know, women in cybersecurity. I've seen a lot more female CISOs that I'm working with very large organizations, and they're doing a phenomenal job, and they're really helping to recruit a more diverse workforce as part of their security organization, because now, you know, young women who want to get into cybersecurity can have somebody that they can look up to and that looks like them, and then they can help, you know, recruit more people. I think we need to recruit more diverse ethnic backgrounds as well, because the only way to solve this problem is through diversity of thought. Bottom line is the people who are attacking us are very diverse and they're multinational and they're from all over the world. If we want to be able to stop them, we need to be able to think like them. And if we want to think like them, we need to have as diverse of a workforce as we possibly can. So I think diversity is helping. I think we could use a lot more of it. And I think there are some amazing women that are leading this space. I probably shouldn't say her name without asking her, but I'm thinking of a specific CISO in my mind right now who's built a phenomenal team of people, and a very diverse team that's doing a fantastic job. And in a vertical, and they're a law firm in a vertical that historically isn't known for their cybersecurity excellence. We're starting to see it more and more. So I think diversity is the key to making that better.
Right. Okay. Now, there have been a lot of headlines as of late, you know, where we're seeing the PII, the personally identifiable information, being hacked into. And now they're just making their way to the dark web. And this is now called the cybercrime economy. What are you seeing with respect to that? The trends, dark web, you know, it's like, you know, Facebook data is always, I mean, you hear about Facebook every day. Something's going on. There's always like three or four headlines going on with Facebook. And I'm seeing more hacks into websites where, you know, like usernames, passwords, they're not being available on the dark web. What's your perspective on that?
It's really interesting. I had a different perspective before Thursday. Thursday I was out speaking at a conference for General Dynamics, Dynamic Connections is what it was called. And I can't remember the lady's name, but she gave a fascinating presentation on what is the dark web, what is the deep web, what is the clear web. And she wanted to remind everyone, and I think it's worth repeating, that the dark web is a place where illicit marketplaces exist and crime is happening, but it's also a place where perfectly legitimate content is hosted, and, you know, people with concerns for their own privacy for non-criminal reasons are using this dark web, if you will, the Tor network being the most common usage of the dark web, for perfectly legitimate purposes. For example, you can sign into your Facebook via the dark web, and you can read content on the New York Times via the dark web, and she was showing that. So the dark web is a place, it is a tool, And for people who are very into privacy and don't want people to be able to spy on them and track them and market to them based on their behaviors, and are very concerned about what organizations are doing with their information and don't happen to live under the protections of the GDPR or anything like it, the dark web is a perfectly legitimate way to browse the internet. All that being said, anytime you have anything that's designed with privacy in mind, criminals will exploit it, and they've done that with the dark web, because if it's hard to track your perfectly legal behavior, it's also hard to track their perfectly illegal behavior. And so we are seeing naturally that the dark web consists of a cybercrime economy that is thriving, and there are marketplaces where you can buy things. I think one of the other things that came up on Thursday that's worth repeating is, you know, it's not just that, you know, you have people buying and selling things on these marketplaces. This is a marketplace also for services. So different parts of the malicious actors' work are being specialized in, which means people are getting better at it. So there are people who just write malware, and they can offer their malware as a service to other fraudsters who want to actually profit from stolen data. And every step along the chain has become highly specialized, which means that the attacks have become far more sophisticated. But if you tell me that the answer to that is to destroy a network of computers where people can browse privately, that the freedom lover in me says it's probably not something that we should do. So it does make law enforcement's job more difficult, but if you wanted to make law enforcement's job really, really easy, we could surrender all of our constitutional rights, freedoms, and protections, and then it'd be a lot easier for them to catch criminals too. So I think it's important for us to understand that just because something makes it difficult for law enforcement doesn't mean we should take it away from law-abiding citizens as well.
Now, the next one's an interesting one. I try not to get political in podcasts, and I definitely do have my views on what's happening with this administration, but I'll keep my mouth shut on this one. We keep hearing about nation-state threat actors like North Korea, China, Russia. You know, and the Mueller probe came out. They're done. I don't know if they really exonerate Trump is the right word to use, but what are your thoughts?
Right.
I mean, you've been in the military, and, you know, we all have views. I try to be respectful, but, you know, it's just like talking about the IoT. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so when I talk about nation states, I'm going to leave the whole Mueller probe and the 2018 or 2016 election completely out of it, if you don't mind. I don't know if I have an informed opinion at this point. I feel like most of what's out there is completely misleading, if not false on one side or the other, and who really knows what happened. But ultimately, and I certainly don't pretend to know or really much care what happened either way, what I would say is when it comes to nation states and nation state actors, there's two things we should be extremely concerned about. Number one is intellectual property, because there are countries in the world who don't believe in individual property rights. And if we allow them to steal intellectual property from us, it really does cause economic impact to the United States. We're an economy of ideas. The truth of the matter is, if we were to manufacture something in the United States and there were no intellectual property protections, it would be cheaper to manufacture it somewhere else. It just would. So I think our way of life is dependent on protecting intellectual property. And I think that there are a lot of nation state actors that are out there trying to steal intellectual property. I think it happens even more from business to business, and we really need to pay attention to that. And the nation state actors, frankly, most of the time are successful. They have a very high success rate when they target a piece of intellectual property specifically, whether it's from an American company or any other company. And then the other piece of that equation is it generally isn't going to make the news, because you're not going to see it on a marketplace on the dark web. Nobody's going to bust that transaction because they're just stealing it and using it. So there's really no way to know that happened unless you catch the breach itself, which most often does not happen. So that's something we should be very concerned about. The other thing I would say about nation state actors that we need to be concerned about is the truth of the matter is very few countries would attack the United States in kinetic warfare. However, there is a lot of precedent. I think there's so much distraction. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the Russian government was involved in some of this Mueller probe nonsense, because it's distracting us from what's happening in the Ukraine, where cyber weapons are being tested to shut down power plants in the dead of winter and actually put people's lives at risk just to see if they can exert control over a foreign country by interfering with their critical infrastructure. That's a big deal. That is a really big deal. And any country in the world could attack us like that. And the response, if you could attribute that attack, would be overwhelming in terms of military force that we would use, I have to believe. But what if you don't know who did it? Right? What if you don't know? And what if people use that to cripple your infrastructure? And this is a whole nother side of the nation-state attack that we're just really scratching the surface of. And if you look around the world and if you look hard enough, there are examples where this stuff can and is being done. It's just not being done to us or our allies yet. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why people are being distracted. But I think the next person to attack us isn't going to bomb us. I think they're going to shut down our power plants or something like that. And that's well, something we need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, now this is a good segue to the next question. The cyber threat landscape, how do you foresee that changing, evolving? And I want to get your thoughts on two things. One is the critical infrastructure that you just alluded to, because I've been, you know, a lot of my podcast guests and some of the blogs I've written on have been about, like, how they can literally bring city to its knees, like Chicago, I mean, or even Denver, where you're at, how they can literally bring it to its knees, and they can shut down the water supply, electricity, and then from there have, like, you know, another cascading effect on the IT infrastructure. In other words, you could be like 9/11, but multiplied by 10 times more. You don't need, you know, 767 crashing buildings. You know, and they're taking advantage of these air-gapped structures, these legacy systems. And another area I was going to ask you about, too, is, like, cybersecurity insurance, because now I've been reading a lot where insurance companies are now really starting to take this seriously and offering it to customers. It's, like, becoming almost as important as health insurance. So, like, just if you can mesh all that together and give me your thoughts and all that, you know, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'll take cybersecurity insurance first because that's probably the easiest answer. I think there's more of a marketplace evolving. There's organizations, insurance organizations are starting to really figure out what their offerings should be and the options and how to build the risk tables and all those things. Insurance is good, but it's not, you can't do it in lieu of cybersecurity. And I think that's what a lot of business executives want. They want to be able to pay a bill and make this whole problem go away. Can't do that because you can insure direct damage and direct costs to recovering from a breach and outages and insure even the cost of providing things like identity monitoring to your consumer base. But what you can insure is damage to your brand reputation or loss of intellectual property because there's really no way to value that that you can agree upon with an insurance company. And that's really the issue that I think people need to keep in mind. So a short summary of that, insurance isn't bad, and if you want it, you should have it. But just know that that's not all you need to do. You also need to protect your infrastructure and protect your data. The other piece of that, how is the cybersecurity landscape changing or is it going to change? I think the actors groups are kind of that the FBI has defined are kind of going to stay, and I'll probably miss a couple, but it's at a high level, the big ones are criminals and terrorists and nation state actors and those types of things. And then, you know, your call it anonymous in their ilk, right? The people who want to make a point more than they want to profit. And there's a few other actor groups that they define. I think they're going to stay the same. What I would tell you is that the actors are going to get better at what they do. And they're going to get better at what they do quickly for two reasons. One, because the way the dark web has evolved and the way that services are sold on the dark web means that people can specialize. And anytime you allow people to specialize in any economy, then you get higher quality work. And I think we will see higher quality work from the threat actor groups increasingly in the future. They'll learn to take advantage of new technologies. They'll also specialize and they'll become experts in one part of the cyber attack kill chain, which historically it hasn't been the case. So you'd find actor groups that were good at one thing and not good at another. And that would really help us with attribution. I think that's going away. They're going to get better at what they do and it's going to get harder to find them. So that's number one in how I think it's going to change. The other thing I would say is I think we're going to see more and more, there's the volume of that population is going to go up. I've heard the term the next billion users, but it's easy to forget that the majority of the world still isn't connected to the internet, and that's changing rapidly. There's more and more people connecting to the internet. Then you say, all right, well, you also combine that with the fact that in a lot of places in this world, the best opportunity for a smart kid is cybercrime, because their local economy does not necessarily offer the opportunities that we enjoy here for kids. The really smart kids are going and being criminals, and it doesn't have the social stigma that it has here. And in some societies around the world, it's encouraged. So you add the fact that economic opportunity for crime is better in a lot of places than it is to join a legitimate profession, with the fact that a lot of those places are now being connected to the internet where they hadn't been in the past, I think you have the ingredients for a lot more cyber criminal actors in the near future.
Okay. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show here, I just want to ask you one final question. I keep getting asked this by a lot of people, and I ask this in turn to all my guests and you and my clients I have for, you know, my writing services. What do you recommend for people in business to protect themselves from cyber threats, cyber attacks, maybe more specifically from data theft? I mean, there's so much of, you know, tips, this, that out there. From your deep experience and from your role as a CTO, what do you recommend people?
Well, you know, I think I could probably sum it up in one word. I recommend that people think. Think about what you're doing. Think about the data that you're sharing and who you're sharing it with. And just think. I think technology has made it so easy for us to do things. We don't think about what we're doing. Now, the truth of the matter is, we can go through all these different permutations of cybersecurity awareness training. The average person doesn't need to know as much as I know or you know about cybersecurity. But they do need to think about what they're doing and take reasonable precautions. And I think that it's incumbent upon the organizations that then get a hold of their data to also think, but they should have a higher bar of what they should be expected to do to protect that information, because they have more resources and they have professionals on staff. But we do have to think. And I'll leave you with, you know, a quote. I want to say it was Bruce Schneier, because I'd like to attribute everything I don't know to him because he's awesome. But I don't think it was in this case. But there's a quote that keeps playing over my mind as we talk about this, and it kind of wraps in artificial intelligence, machine learning, with this whole concept of individual users just thinking about what they're doing. And the quote is, the question isn't whether machines think, but whether people do. And I think as we continue to go down this journey, we need to think about what we're doing.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Jeremy, we thank you for your time this afternoon, and we look forward to hearing from you again, and hopefully having our podcast here in your future. I really enjoyed the show.
Yeah, thank you, Robbie. Me as well.
Take care. Bye.